Okay. Well, on his day of election to Parliament back in 1956, Jim Plans declared in his speech, "The purpose of Labor is not to make governments, but to make better social conditions. I believe Labor will be prepared to remain in opposition rather than give up its policy by identifying with the parties of big business." Well, okay. So, and after that, for almost two decades in Parliament, Cairns was widely regarded as the chief theorist and spokesperson for the Labor left. He was the leading voice in Parliament, arguing for fundamental change in society, for a vision of socialism, for workers' control of industry. And Jim Cairns didn't combine his activities just to making the odd speech or two in Parliament. He threw himself into broader political activism, and the high point of which, of course, was the leading role he played in the movement against the Vietnam War. So in this context, to even mention Jim Cairns' name in the same breath as Julia Gillard or Wayne Swan or Kevin Rudd and so on would be another travesty. Jim Cairns, for all his weaknesses, and some of them I'll go through, of course, was, you know, a cut above anything that exists in the Labor Party today, or exists in Parliament, in the Greens for that matter. He wanted to abolish capitalism. He wanted a new society for workers. And, you know, the comparison today is very sharp then, where we have all of the Labor Party leaders and politicians, you know, through all the factions and so on, all at the beck and call of big business. All, you know, not just that they're not having any vision of fundamental social change in society, the only thing they have is the same chorus of neoliberal orthodoxy. Okay. But all that said, for all his idealism, his commitment to human liberation and egalitarianism, good intentions are not enough in politics unless they're backed up with a strategy that can actually bring about fundamental social change. And that's what Jim Cairns lacked. Because in the end, because he didn't have such a vision or strategy, and he didn't break with the Labor Party, or not just break with the Labor Party, but he didn't break with the idea that fundamental change could be brought by Parliament. In the end, rather than, you know, as the person that got into Parliament, like so many before him, to change society, to represent workers, to make major advances, rather than carrying that task through, actually he ended up being used by the very forces that he saw himself as wanting to fight. You know, through the course of his role in the Whitlam government and so on, in many ways against his own will, he ended up, you know, heading off workers' struggles, incorporating workers into the system, becoming a prop for capitalism. And in Australia, in the 1970s, in a period when Australian capitalism was going through some of its greatest challenges, when workers were surging forward in struggle. Okay. But precisely because Jim Cairns wasn't a time server like the Wayne Swans and the Gillards and so on, you know, wasn't just, you know, a loyal servant of the Murdoch press and so on, he ultimately came to recognise what had happened. You know, his critique subsequently what happened in the Whitlam government and his own role in it was quite sharp. He saw the fact that he'd been co-opted and abused, and that by the real power in society, the capitalist class. And he ended up in 1977 then resigning from Parliament, utterly demoralised. And I think that is a very important political lesson for the left today and in the coming years. Because if somebody like Jim Cairns, who genuinely wanted social change, who did have a vision of society and was prepared to make a stand, he was committed, he was a fighter and so on, he couldn't bring about fundamental change through Parliament, and that when he was a million miles to anything that exists left today. By, like, compared to, say, Bob Brown, who people think is some sort of left-winger, like, Bob Brown's a fascist compared to what Jim Cairns was, and that, well, if Jim Cairns couldn't do it, well, it really points to the fact that the idea of bringing fundamental change through Parliament, and that, whether it's by the Greens or some revitalised left-wing of the Labor Party, is another nonsense. It's unachievable, and it's a dead end. And that, and so I think that's one of the most important lessons that comes from the whole experience of Jim Cairns. Okay, so who was Jim Cairns? He was brought up in a poor, but a pro-labor, family, which had, was quite Christian, in the sort of, Methodist sort of, Protestant tradition. He was brought up by his grandparents and his single mother, who had a small farm, to the north of Melbourne, on the outskirts of Sunbury, and that, farm, during the Great Depression, was, they lost it, and it was taken by the banks, taken off by the banks. So he had no love for the bankers, and he also had a bitter hostility from his youth to the surrounding area with some very large properties of the rural establishment and that. So he had no love for the bankers or the rural establishment. But until he was into his 30s, he was not essentially engaged in politics, and that, you know, he was pro-labor family and so on, didn't like the rich and powerful, but he was removed from politics. He was forced to, leave school, to support his family at the height of the Great Depression. And in that situation, of course, it was extremely difficult to get a job. Eventually he got a job as a clerk, and then, and quite surprisingly, history for somebody so left-wing, he first had his first stable employment as a cop. And he was a member of the police force for a number of years. And he became increasingly disillusioned through the course of the late 1930s and the early war years with the police force, especially after he was given a job in the police special branch. The special branch is the spy organisation of the police force, the spy on the workers' movement and the left and so on. And he was a member of the special branch. And he got out of that. And that in the interim, he'd started to do a course at Melbourne University in economics and started to read Karl Marx. He, towards the end of the war, he joined the army, and in the Pacific, he made contact with a couple of rank and file activists in the army who were members, who went on to become quite leading members of the Communist Party, and that. At the end of the war, he obtained a job as a tutor in economic history at Melbourne University. And in that period, he was more and more reading Marxist literature, and was around the Communist Party. And that clearly, for that period, he was open very much to become a Marxist and so on. But he never joined the Communist Party for a combination of factors, and we don't know the exact balance. Partly it was because of the Communist Party leadership was suspicious of him because of his background in the police and that, understandably. But also because, well, the version of Marxism on offer from the, you know, the Stalinist Communist Party in the, you know, these years was the height of, you know, rigid Stalinism in the party. And that wasn't a very appealing, you know, there was this, you know, purely formalistic, gutted Stalinist version of Marxism, which left out the working class as an active force in society for change and so on. And then any person, you know, seriously radicalizing, wanting to see a fundamentally different society, well, this wasn't, you know, all that appealing. And that, so he never joined the party. And that, and even though his own critique of Stalinism, you know, would be nowhere near as sharp as we would be in Socialist Alternative, Cairns himself was no Stalinist. And that, for example, for a period he was involved with people in the Communist Party in forming the Australian Peace Council, and that in his early years he played a role in the formation of it. But he resigned from the Peace Council after a year or so because the Peace Council was so tied to every twist and turn of Stalin's reactionary foreign policy. He resigned from the Peace Council in protest over that. The problem was, of course, in the years, the late 1940s and so on, if you saw yourself as a socialist and you wanted to be politically active, and you weren't prepared, and the Communist Party was in Australia
dominated the left. You know, we've got Connacht in Australia. It was easily the largest proportional communist party in the English-speaking world and so on, overwhelmingly dominated the left, and there was not much else on offer. So if you objected the CPA, where'd you go? And, well, eventually went to the Labor Party. There's not much else on offer. But this was despite the fact that when he joined the Labor Party, you know, the very year he joined the Labor Party, he wrote of the Labor Party. He dismissed it as a party of opportunists. Indeed, in 1947, he declared, "The Labor Party has adopted a policy of day-to-day objectives strictly within the capitalist status quo. The Labor Party is the left-wing capitalist party and is not a socialist party at all." So, you know, one level is biting critique of Labourism, and yet the same year, almost a couple of months after he wrote that, he joined the party. There wasn't much else on offer, as I said. That didn't end his political activism at a broader level. He was active in, you know, his proto-trade union, like he was in the staff association at Melbourne University here. You know, it wasn't exactly a union in those days, but he was pushing in the direction of making a union. He was very heavily involved in that. He was involved in a lot of activities around the civil liberties movement and so on. Later on, he got involved in the campaign against the Menzies government attempting to ban the Communist Party and so on. So he's highly active in a number of issues. He was active in support of the struggle for independence in Indonesia. But in the early 50s, he was increasingly drawn into the factional struggle that was going on inside the Labor Party itself. The Victorian executive of the Labor Party had been taken over by the right-wing industrial groupers, you know, which emerged out of Catholic Social Action, and that they dominated the party in Victoria and so on, and were pushing the Labor Party in the context of the Cold War to the right. And Cairns got involved in that bit of factional struggle. And eventually, of course, that factional struggle was to lead to the split in the Labor Party, where the right wing broke away. And you've got to remember, in Victoria, the Democratic Labor Party, the right wing split, took out 2/3 of the Labor Party membership. It had the mass of the members, which it took out from the Labor Party and formed the, you know, anti-communist Democratic Labor Party. And it was in that context that Cairns was pre-selected for the then seat of Yarra, which covered the key inner city working class suburbs, industrial suburbs, the centre of industry in Melbourne, and the centre of what was in those years seen to be the archetype of workers, covered Richmond and Collingwood. And Cairns, of course, by then, you know, university educated academic, you know, in the streets of Richmond in those times. This was weird. Give you a context, and you've got to see the context of the Labor movement, you know, and what most Labor Party committed activists saw. I remember my mother, when Gough Whitlam took over the leadership of the Labor Party, her reaction was, "This is disgusting, Michael. He's been to university. He doesn't speak like your father. How could the Labor Party allow somebody like that to be his leader?" And she said, "Oh, Mr. Cairns, he's more left-wing. He's better than Mr. Whitlam. But still, he's not one of us, is he? He's not one of us." That was the perception. And Richmond was even more bitterly though. So this weirdo, PhD, economic history in the streets of Richmond. Okay. So how did he get the seat? Well, he got it because he had the backing of one Pat Kennelly, who was an archetypal inner city Catholic Labour machine politician. Now, the machine, while the machine politicians in the Labour Party didn't go, even though they were Catholic, didn't go for the grouper split, because if Kennelly would have saw it, is the groupers were too Catholic for their own good. You know, all this religion, you know, it's good for kids, and women, yeah, they need it too, but really, what's this got to do with real politics in the Labour Party? And so the whole inner city, Tammany Hall, machine politicians, a lot of them associated with the Rim Machine and so on, stayed with Labor. And they backed Cairns, you know, and that to be the seat. Give you a feel. These are the sort of politics. Pat Kennelly had a pronounced stutter. It wasn't very good on television debates, but I remember as a kid, he had a debate on television on Meet the Press with B.A. Santa Maria. who was the leading theoretician of the right, of the DLP, associated with the DLP. And Santa Maria accused Pat Kennelly of it in the Labor Party pre-selection, campaign in Dandenong, you stuff the ballot boxes and rigs the vote. And Pat Kennelly says, in his stuttering voice, it's a lie, it's a lie, it's a lie. It wasn't Dandenong, it was Sandringham. Okay, that gives you a feel. So this intellectual, socialist, and so on is precipitated into this seat with the backing of the machine. And that. Now, as I said, the Labor member for the seat previously had gone with the DLP, Stan Keon, and he took out the great bulk of the Labor Party members in the seat, the great bulk. And that meant meant that the federal election there was not going to be no shoo-in for Cairns at all. And he was reliant on the muscle of the Communist Party and left-wing trade unions. And I deliberately used the word muscle because the streets of Richmond then, it wasn't about handing out how-to-vote cards, it was about handing out punches and that. And so this was probably one of those vile and bitterly fought, in every sense of the word, election campaign and that. And where eventually, and that, because you remember in Richmond, heavily industrial suburbs, great factories and so on, it was also the concentration of the DLP vote, but it was also where the Communist Party had one of its strongest base of supports. So it was people like handing out power votes for Cairns. He drew from Melbourne University a number of students and so on that came in and backed it, but a lot of other people doing the heavy work were people like Norm Gallagher and so on, Cairns had to turn a blind eye to how people were dealt with and that. Okay, Cairns won that first election, narrowly won the seat. Okay, now, once in Parliament, Cairns went on to be, through the 50s, the most outspoken Labor MP. Though, by the mid-50s, he had softened his politics somewhat. It evolved towards being a more conventional social democrat, By this stage, he believed in the parliamentary road to socialism. And he declared in his maiden speech, it is a function of Parliament to make and unmake social conditions. But that said, he was nonetheless prepared to make a stand through the 50s and into the 60s on questions which left him extremely isolated. He was one of the very few Labor MPs at the time who was prepared to oppose the White Australia policy, which had been an article of faith of the Labor Party since formation and which had been backed by both the left and right of the party. And a whole series of other issues, he was prepared to make a stand. As he himself declared, I push for things that are not yet popular. And that was reflected in a whole series of issues, whether it was sexual politics and so on. But of course it was the Vietnam War, really pushed him to prominence and that. And Vietnam for a whole period became his great passion. In 1965, the Menzies government, the Liberal government committed Australian troops to fight in Vietnam. And from then on, Cairns played a leading role in building the movement against the war. I mean, obviously he spoke against it in Parliament, that was only small beer. Compared to people somehow think all the Greens a bit activisty and so on in the campaign. This gives you a feel for just such a nonsense and how right-wing they are compared to, what Cairns and people he would like and that. In terms of mobilising, between 1964 and 1966, and so space for a couple of years, Jim Cairns addressed 600 public meetings on the Vietnam War. So it's probably an average of two a day or something like that. 600 public meetings on the Vietnam War, and then participated in innumerable demonstrations, both large and small. Now, that's activism and by the late 60s, his politics increasingly moved outside Parliament to focus on activism to build a movement on the streets. He did not Totally abandoned an orientation to Parliament, but clearly he was moving the whole period beyond it to some idea of participatory democracy that went beyond Parliament. And of course, the high point of his activism came with the moratorium campaign in 1970 and the next couple of years afterwards, and that against the war, and with the major rallies around Australia nationwide on the 8th of May 1970, the first moratorium march, and that. And a sense of how controversial this was in society. It's hard to imagine today. Like when 300,000 more people went on the streets in Melbourne against the war in Iraq, this was a huge demonstration, fantastic demonstration. But this was not controversial. To march in the moratorium against the Vietnam War, this was saying you were a red rag communist who wanted to destroy all the values of Australian society. And that, you know, the hysteria around it, the fact that people were going, you know what they're going to do? Sit down on the streets of Bourke Street and shut down the city. You know, the shops were all boarded up. You know, this was going to be mass rioting, uncontrollable, sexual frenzy, whatever. You know, every element of society with so-called respectable opinion were denouncing this. There's going to be blood on the streets. And Cairns played a very important role in that context of holding the movement together in the face of all this. And as well, I think the fact that Cairns, and not just Cairns, but the Victorian executive and the leadership of the machine in the Labor Party in Victoria backed the moratorium marches here is an important element explaining why they were so much bigger in Melbourne than in Sydney, for example, where the right-wing controlled Labor Party machine refused to back the demonstrations. So we get 100,000 people in the face of incredible hostility and frenzy marching against the war in Melbourne and sitting down. Now, course of this, of course, Cairns was demonised by the right in society. But also, of course, he had more than a share of his enemies on the left. And in particular, of course, Cairns was demonised by the Maoists, who were the largest force in the Melbourne student left. As one of Cairns' biographers, Paul Strangio, writes, although Cairns assumed hero status amongst many of the younger generation, the militants treated him as one of their most dangerous enemies. Now, the scale of the Maoist hostility reflected their own, you know, sectarian ultra-left sort of politics, you know, the high Stalinism. They had no conception of genuine United Front work, of being prepared to work with, you know, left-wing reformists like Cairns in order to build a movement. You know, of course, there's plenty of prisoners to be made of Cairns and not going to make them, but prepared to work with people like that in order to build a movement. You know, the Maoist whole approach and reflecting the history of Stalin's approach was either you were totally uncritical in support of somebody, they were a great hero, or they were fascists, basically. There's nothing in between and that. And that was combined with, you know, this super inflated sense of their own importance in the world. You know, they were the leadership, or they should be, and everybody should bow down and recognise that. Okay. Now, I'll now go on to, of course, to make some of the criticisms. Well, if you talk around Vietnam, of course, there's plenty of criticism to be made. Like, in the course of the 60s, the whole period, Cairns backed away from the call for the immediate withdrawal of Australian troops from Vietnam. And after the 1966 elections, which Labor under Cold War had taken a more leftist position against the war, after they were defeated in that election and Whitlam became the leader, Whitlam, of course, wanted to run away from the Vietnam issue, and Cairns tailed behind Whitlam. He didn't challenge the fact that Whitlam wanted to drop opposition to Vietnam. He shut up for a whole period. And worse, in 1970, when at Whitlam's urging, the Federal Labor Party executive intervened to smash and overturn the Victorian leadership, the left-wing leadership in Victoria, Cairns shut up and acquiesced to federal intervention in order to avoid a split in the Labor Party. Yet, on the other hand, he played, I would argue, a largely positive role in the anti-war movement. He acted as a unifying force, Unlike so many other so-called leaders and saw themselves as leaders of the movement, he was actually committed to the democracy of the movement and that. So, for example, you know, Cairns was not on the left of the movement, when the sit-down at the first moratorium, he actually initially spoke against it in the internal meetings and that. But once the democratic decision had been made on a proposal from the left of the movement to have a sit-down, he actually went along with it and defended it. He became the main public spokesperson for it. So his credit was he was prepared to be prepared, unlike most MPs or other leaders, to accept, well, he was defeated and he would defend the decision and that. And he played an important role in defending the sit-down tactic in the face of the hysterical attacks upon it. Now, the other criticism we would have, of course, is that, you know, Cairns, you know, had this, very strong opposition to militant protests and so on. Fighting the police. The Maoists were dogmatically committed to fighting the police at every, flip of the coin. Which is silly, but quite clearly militant protests had an important role to play in the movement, and some sort of Gandhian pacifism wasn't going to be the way forward. But on the other hand, Cairns, was a strong defender in the movement of civil disobedience and of breaking the law. He publicly urged young men not to register for national service and to defy conscription. And he was arrested in part of the campaign to defy the Melbourne City Council's ban on the handing out of leaflets in the streets of Melbourne. And on the other hand as well, though, on the question of militancy, on the specific question of street fighting and militancy at the first moratorium march, I think his position was right. The very fact of having 100,000 people in the face of the hysteria that was going on to sit down in the streets of Melbourne in a peaceful protest, that was a victory. And so the Maoists and many of the other, ultra-lefts in the student movement who wanted to lead a breakaway march to go and fight the police, I think at the first moratorium march, this was madness. This was just cutting the revolutionary left off from the massive protesters. And it could only, serve to isolate them. Okay. At the end of 1972, Cairns wrote a book, The Quiet Revolution. And he wrote in it, in one of his most left-wing statements, "Social Democrats decided that it was the state or the government that really had power, and that all you needed to do was to win an election and you would have control of the place where power really was located. But power is not located mainly or wholly in Parliament. In an industrialised society, power is located in the productive system, in the factories, banks, stores, offices, newspapers, TV networks, universities, and so on. Parliament is only one of the many places where power is located. In an economically advanced society, any government is circumscribed, conditioned, neutralised, and often dominated by some or many of these more basic power centres. In a very significant sense, Labor cannot gain power at all simply by winning an election. A Labor government can operate its administration within the limits imposed by the basic power centres of which the social structure consists." Now, this is pretty much close to a Marxist analysis of the role of the state and the possibility of the role of a former government and that. And he went on to emphasise the central role of the working class in changing society. He just said, the workers that have played a decisive importance in the struggle for a better society. He argued for a coalition of young radicals and workers to achieve mass change in consciousness, a revolutionary change. So he was for revolution. But, he wrote, "Yes, I'm all in favour of revolution, a quiet, gentle revolution in people's values. This will bring about a new society, away from the acquisitive, competitive nature of today's society to one based on unselfishness and cooperation. That kind of cultural change is the only one that can be of significance." He wrote this just before he has become a minister in the Labor government. Yet, after December 1972, with the Whitlam government elected, actually he pulled his head in very quickly, lowered his sights, and pretty much went along with Whitlam's government. Indeed, as in the first period, he was a minister for industry and overseas trade, and he was highly praised by the Bosses Association, the Chamber of Manufacturers. And after returning from a trade mission to China in 1973, he declared, until I became a minister, I'd never met many of the captains of industry. You know, they are very intelligent. Yeah, well, maybe. And after Labor was re-elected in May 1974, he stood for the deputy leadership of the party and won it quite comfortably. So he was quite clearly the mainstream of the Labor Party had accepted him. But by 1974, the Labor government was being thrown into utter disarray and turmoil by the impact of the world economic crisis. The traditional Keynesian policies that both the mainstream Labor left and right had adhered to were totally useless in the face of the sharp rise in unemployment and so on and the like. And the government came under tremendous pressure from the establishment and the reinvigorated Liberal Party under their new extreme right-wing leader, Malcolm Fraser. Not seen as an extreme right-wing leader today, but that tells you something about today's politics. And they were under pressure to abandon any reforming measures and to slash and burn, impose the cost of the crisis on workers. But 1974 in Australia, workers were not taking this lying down, any measure at all. There had already been the massive strike at Four Broadmeadows, the riot of the Greek workers there and so on, which had shut down the factory. It was the highest level of industrial action in Australia since the Red Year of 1919, you know, immediately after the war. And so massive working class upsurge going on. And in the face of rising inflation in industry after industry, there was strike after strike. And that. In the face of this pressure, Cairns increasingly began to falter. And he joined in the chorus of Labor politicians condemning the unions for going on strike for, you know, too big a pay rise, supposedly. And in particular, he called on the Labor government to abandon the promise that it had made on its re-election in the 1974 election when the policy speech had guaranteed a 35-hour week for public servants. He called on them to jettison that policy. He also, in this period, in his role as industry for minister, became known as Dr. Yes, and in terms of giving huge bailouts to failing companies and so on to keep them going, in particular the multinational car companies. And in 1974, as unemployment continued to rise, he declared forlornly, "I don't want anyone to be put out of work. It's not the government that'll be putting anyone out of work. It's the system." Yeah, well, a cop-out. And most notoriously, at the February 1975 Labor Party National Conference at Terrigal in New South Wales, Labor made, you know, its profound ideological shift, where for the first time it openly, you know, embraced the profits, you know, that declared it was for profits for the first time, you know, and Cairns led the charge. His speech at the conference is quite revealing. He declared, "I am a socialist, and that I believe in cooperation and equality, and I deplore avarice and aggressiveness. I know that the capital system is exploitative and leaves many desires of many people unfulfilled. I also know that ours is a capitalist economy. I know the jobs of most of our people depend on private industry, most of it part of the multinational system. It's time for the ALP to say quite clearly and categorically that our socialist objective does not prevent recognition that the basic needs of the Australian people are dependent at this stage on our development of a profitable private sector." It was another capitulation. Nonetheless, despite this capitulation, Cairns drew the line at draconian austerity measures, which were being demanded by big business, the Treasury officials and so on. And he forced through a budget, and it was pretty much his doing, forced through a budget that actually, in the face of all this weight of opinion, increased government expenditure. This was too much for the powers that be, who put all the pressure on Whitlam. And in June 1975, Whitlam moved and sacked Clyde Cameron, the other leading left-wing cabinet minister, as Minister for Labour and Industry, who was my minister at the time, worked in his department, and sacked Cairns as treasurer and replaced him with Bill Hayden, who then went on to introduce the first neoliberal budget. And that. It was the beginning of the neoliberal era. You know, Hayden introduced a savage austerity measures attacking workers and that. And in the immediate aftermath, of course, unemployment rose to a post-war high. It was the beginning of the neoliberal era. But, of course, the capitalist class was not satisfied. In alliance with the media barons and the public service bureaucracy, the heads of the bureaucracy, they conspired to bring down the Labor government. And Labor was tossed aside like the squeezed lemon that it was. Replaced in a coup carried out by the unelected Governor General, Sir John Kerr, which brought Malcolm Fraser to power on November the 11th, 1975. At the time of economic crisis, the bourgeoisie preferred, the outright party of big business, not a party that, despite all its betrayals, was still looked to by the most class-conscious section of the working class. Again, workers didn't take this lying down either. There were massive protest rallies, bitterly angry strikes and so on, and that against the coup. The ruling class was extremely worried. The army was put on a red alert and so on. And there was, it was every possibility, of an ongoing general strike. But the Labor leaders, both left and right, Cairns included, and the union leaders, left and right, including Communist Party union leaders, did all they could to head off any concerted challenge to the system. They feared a mass movement that would go outside their control and that would take on the rule of capital. As Bob Hawke, then the leader of the ACTU, put it, there was a real possibility, he wrote, that the movement would unleash forces the like of which we have never seen before. And that was the last thing Hawke wanted. The ALP leaders had well served the interests of big business. They had been demoralised and betrayed their supporters, and consequently, their unwillingness to fight meant that they were slaughtered at the election. In his book, published subsequently, Oil on Troubled Waters, Cairns wrote insightfully about the downfall of the Whitlam government. He wrote, "The victory of the Liberal country parties was not a victory of an alternative to Labor. It was a victory of the prevailing hegemony, made more certain by Labor's acknowledgement and acceptance of so much of it. We were not replaced by an alternative. We were assimilated by the true, inverted commas, representatives of what we had finally so much admitted was true." Unfortunately, all these insights were way too late. I'm not going to say too much about Cairns and subsequent career here, but in the aftermath of the Kerr coup, Cairns, as I said, was sorely demoralised and retreated from politics and became involved in the alternative lifestyle movement for a period, helping to organise the down-to-earth festivals. But by the early 80s, he had cut his ties with the counterculture. It had proved just as much a dead end as had been the ideas of looking to Parliament for fundamental change. By the late 1980s, Cairns had drifted back to a more political approach and reaffirmed his commitment to socialism. And though he did subsequently rejoin the Labor Party, he remained, an advocate of socialism and a critic of Labor from the left. The tragedy was that he'd never been one to a genuine Marxist approach of looking to mobilising the mass of workers from below because of that, he hadn't used his profound talents that he did have and his widespread popularity to build a fighting revolutionary alternative to Labor's betrayals. And I'll leave it there.